and hauled her off the yacht. I don't mention that I did, in fact, pop her on the head, and then I left her right there in the clutches of the murderous sex trafficking ring. Not my finest hour, I'll admit. She's furious at first, but as I drive north, I calm her down, and it's clear Talissa knows what I know. That Roxana's desire to live up to her sister's expectations was what put her on that boat, not me. And it's also what's keeping her on that boat now. She asks,
"What was she like? Her condition? Mentally?"
She doesn't blame you for anything. She is as strong as I've seen from someone in this situation. Talissa turns to me.
"You have seen people in this situation?"
"Similar situations, yes. The trauma bonds can be built quickly, and they can be very powerful. She's a trooper for fighting back the way she is."
"How do you know about trauma bonds?"
With only a little hesitation, I say, "I have some training."
"In kidnapping people for slavery?"
"No, in being held hostage. There is a school for it. You learn survival, evasion, resistance, and escape."
"Where is this school?"
"Can't say."
"Of course you can't."
"The point is, you can be taught how to resist your captors, and you can build up a lot of defenses to their techniques. But these young people snatched off the street, out of nightclubs, picked up through modeling agencies, thrown into this world, I can't imagine what they are going through psychologically. Whatever it is, they don't stand a chance. But Roxana's tough. She's really tough."
"So, what is our plan now, Harry? We just leave Roxana with them and wait to hear from her?"
"No. We're going to Venice. They will be there tonight unless me showing up on La Primorosa changed their entire agenda. I can't rule out that possibility, but so far the pipeline seems to have continued on, despite my harassment, with only a few diversions." Talissa asks,
"And when we get to Venice, what will we do there?"
"The other girls will be sold off, and they'll all go to different groups, different countries. If I can't stop it tonight, I'll never get another chance to save those victims I saw in Bosnia. But I sure as hell can't save those women by myself. I've been trying and failing at this since that night in Mostar when my actions made their awful predicament even more awful. I know now that I need a hand, and I also know where to go for it. Maybe." "This has gotten too big," I say. "We're going to have to try to bring in some help."
"But the police are corrupt."
"I'm not talking about the police."
"Who then?"
I sigh, and then drive in silence for a moment. Only when she asks me a second time do I reply. "Some acquaintances. But you need to understand one thing. They will either make the situation better, or they will make the situation worse. It's only out of desperation that I'm reaching out to them."
"But who are they?"
"I can't tell you," I say, and then I turn back to her. "Trust me." She nods and looks out the window. Soon, she starts to sniff back tears, no doubt thinking about Roxana, somewhere out to sea. An hour later, we're in the Italian town of Villa Opicina as the sun rises onto a clear morning. Talissa is sitting on a stone bench in front of a church, and I'm walking around the grounds with my earpiece in. No one is in sight this early, save for a couple of nuns who passed by me a minute ago, and they didn't exactly trigger my threat radar, so I feel secure enough for now. I place a call that I have been considering but dreading for days and days now. It's 2 a.m. in D.C., which means I'll be waking up someone on the eastern seaboard, but I honestly don't give a shit. After 5 rings, the call is answered with a sleepy female voice. "Brewer?" "Hey, it's me." Suzanne Brewer is my handler at CIA. To say our relationship is difficult would be underselling it significantly. She is not my biggest fan, which is also an understatement. In fact, it is entirely possible, perhaps even probable, that she tried to kill me a couple months ago. I don't trust her. But right now, I'm out of options.
"Me who?"
She's just being difficult. It's par for the course from her. It's Violator. She takes a few more seconds to wake up. I can hear her climbing out of her bed and walking, probably over to a computer in her house. She says,
"Ident code?"
I groan to myself and want to tell her, "For fuck's sake, you know who this is," but I don't. Not because I'm above that sort of talk, but because I need something from her now. I answer with a clipped, "Ident to follow. Whiskey, hotel, Quebec, Fiverr, 2, 3, India." The pause is brief. The voice is annoyed.
"Ident confirmed."
I lay on the charm now, as thick as I can. "How's it going?"
"It would be going better if you were working instead of on another one of your vacations."
I think about the past week and realize how much I wish I could take a vacation from this vacation. But I say, "I'll be back soon. Sooner, actually, if you give me a little help. It's really important."
"You wouldn't be calling if you didn't need help. You wouldn't be calling at this hour if it weren't important. What do you want?"
This is going well so far. I decide to add to my charm offensive to reel her in. "You feeling better?" Suzanne Brewer had been shot a couple of months earlier. She fell into my arms, in fact, and I guess I probably saved her life. That's how I remember it, anyway, although my recollection of the incident is a bit fuzzy. I hope that's how she remembers it as well, to earn me a little more respect in her eyes, so she'll give me what I need. But she barks back at me.
"I asked you what you wanted."
"Nope." The Ice Queen is as frosty as ever, despite the fact that I stopped her from bleeding out back in the UK. I reply with, "I need whatever the agency knows about a sex trafficking ring referred to as the Consortium."
"Perhaps you are confused."
"Confused about what?"
"Let me explain how this is all supposed to function. You work for this intelligence agency, Violator. This intelligence agency does not work for you."
"Yeah, I knew it was going to be like this. Though I was hopeful it would be all unicorns and rainbows. Hope is not a strategy," I tell myself yet again. Then I tell myself, screw it. I turn off my faux charm and let her have it. Just cut the shit and do this for me. Lives are at stake.
"Lives are at stake all the time with everything we do. Every single day you run off to go find yourself or whatever the hell you do during your hiatuses. Lives are threatened. The program you belong to needs you. And you are out there."
"Please, Suzanne. Please get me something." She stops bitching, which is a first, and then she sighs, which happens all the time. Finally, she says,
"I've never heard of the Consortium."
"What about the pipeline?"
"What is that?"
"It's kind of like an underground railroad for the trafficked women, a smuggling circuit the victims are put through by the Consortium."
"No, I've never heard of that either."
She sounds credible, but again, she also sounded credible when she said she hadn't been trying to shoot me in the back of the head in Scotland, and I retain doubts about that event. I say, "Fine. But I bet you are sitting in front of a snazzy computer that has access to all sorts of super secret files and databases, and you can query those terms in that context and find out if the agency has any intel I can use."
"Yes, I do have just such a computer in front of me, but what do I get out of this?"
As I walk through the garden of the church in the cool morning, it occurs to me, and not for the first time, that everybody wants something from me. What do you get? How about my unwavering devotion?
"I already have a cat, Violator."
"Of course you do. Just tell me what you want from me."
"If I give you this intel, will you come back to DC?
"Not immediately. I need actionable intel so I can act. But as soon as I'm done with..." She interrupts.
"Sorry, Violator. I need you. Your country needs you."
"I'll kiss your ass and I'll kiss the flag, probably not in that order, very soon. But for now, I need to know about the Consortium. Seems to be run by an American male in his 50s. He used the name Tom, but that's going to be a pseudonym. There's an American female psychologist and a South African involved as well. A rich Greek dude. He's dead. Don't know his name."
"How did he die?"
she asks, but the way she asks tells me she has a pretty good suspicion that I killed him. Would you believe natural causes? Brewer just sighs again. I continue. The organization either owns or has access to a mega-yacht called La Primorosa. Right now, it's in the northern Adriatic heading to Venice, unless they change their plans. Brewer sounds like she's typing all this into her computer. Then she says,
Fine, give me an hour and I'll call you back.
This went better than I thought. Momentarily stunned by my powers of persuasion, I can't even speak.
Violator?
I do my best to recover. Yeah, that's great. Let me call you, though. 1 hour. The line goes dead, and I stand there in the middle of the well-kept church grounds, staring up at the steeple. It's a magnificent sight on this sunny, warm morning. But all I can think about is tonight and the 23 women and girls who have been on my mind since Bosnia. My best chance to save them is a woman who hates my guts, and an organization that regularly uses me while offering little in return. But if this doesn't work, another option comes to mind. It chills me to think about employing Plan B, but I may just be desperate enough to do so. 32. An hour later, I'm parked at a gas station near the Italian town of Porto Gruaro. Talissa is sitting in the car eating a pastry for breakfast, and I'm lying 25 yards away in the grass by the parking lot, looking up at the sky. I'm tired as hell again, and I know I'm going to have to find a way to sleep before tonight, but that's not all I need, so I call Suzanne Brewer back. She answers, and I say, Violator. And then I play the game by the rules. IDIN code Whiskey Hotel Quebec 5023 India.
Confirmed.
What did you learn? I ask.
I'm transferring you.
Transferring me? It's 3 a.m. there. You're at the office?
I am now,
she says, her voice no more or less annoyed sounding than usual. She adds,
Hold.
And I do. There is no hold music at CIA. Which is too bad because it's a missed opportunity for them to have fun and play the Mission Impossible theme song or some shit. But nobody at Langley I've ever met has that kind of a sense of humor. Soon, the line clicks. Hanley. I launch up to a sitting position on the grass. Matthew Hanley is the deputy director for operations, the top dog in ops. Brewer somehow got him into the building at 3 a.m. for this. Matt and I go way back. He and Brewer are the only two people at Langley who know I'm doing contract work for the agency, and that's because I'm essentially doing contract work directly for Hanley, with Brewer as the go-between. Still, though, Hanley and I have spoken quite a few times over the past couple of years. I was hoping to avoid going all the way up to him in my hunt for intel about an operation I'm running on my own. But I mask my unease. Hey, Matt. All good with you?
Not so great.
What's wrong?
Well, it's simple. I have three operatives in a special sub-ROSA unit. One of them is recovering from injury, one of them is a pain in my ass, and the other is AWOL.
I thought I was the pain in his ass until he mentioned AWOL.
I'm coming back. I just got myself involved in something and I need a little intel to wrap it up.
Brewer shouldn't have bothered you with this. Hanley replies to this with,
The consortium. That means nothing to us. There are sex trafficking rings all over. In your area, Albania and Turkey are big players.
I cock my head slightly. How do you know what area I'm in?
Isn't it obvious?
How is it?
Because of Ratko Babic.
Matt knows I killed the general, or at least he thinks I did, and he's trying to get me to confirm it. If it were anyone else, I probably would play stupid, but it's Hanley.
Right.
He adds,
I wasn't going to ask you if you waxed old Ratko Babic, although from the minute I heard about his death, I knew that you did. Shit, everyone knows. But you're basically admitting it, so I'll just go ahead and say it.
Say what?
Nice work. Not perfect. You fragged a bunch of Serbian goons who were active duty members of their intelligence service. They were also Branjevo partisans, so I'm not going to lose any sleep over that. But our Balkan desk is running interference, insisting to the Serbs that the former asset who became a rogue hitman called the Grey Man was seen in Santiago, Chile, at the same time as the Babic killing.
If I don't work for the agency, then why does the agency give a shit if the Serbs think it was me? We trained you, didn't we? We installed that wacky do-gooder morale compass of yours, didn't we? Yes to the first, no to the second. Well, whatever. The Balkan desk will deal with Serbian intelligence. Wasn't exactly like we had a great relationship with Belgrade in the first place. Roger that. Back to the consortium. Nothing, really? Sex trafficking is the third most profitable criminal enterprise in the world, behind drugs and counterfeiting. It's ahead of the sale of illegal weapons. So, yeah, I'm sure what you're talking about is real. I'm sure the people involved in it are nasty. And I'm sure a lot of poor, helpless victims are abused and enslaved by it. But the specifics of what you are telling us, the Americans, the South African, the pipeline, this doesn't line up with anything we have. Can I get some help from you guys on this? Could you get Brewer to do a little digging? Hanley breathes one of his trademark long sighs, and I can picture his huge frame inside his too large suit, puffing up and then shrinking as every ounce of air leaves his lungs. I can also picture what he's about to say before he says it. I'm about to hear a big fat no. No, Hanley says. You are a hard asset, a denied hard asset at that, unallied with any existing structure in the agency. You are not a case officer, not an analyst, not chief of any station. You don't have read-ins on anything not directly linked to the work we assign you. You have absolutely no standing to ask for resources. I'm not asking because I think I am owed resources. I'm asking as a friend. I need some help. This is serious shit. You know what else is serious shit? Yeah, I do. And again, I know what he's about to say. Your fucking job with us, that's serious shit. I've got a backlog of work I need you to take care of. Get one of the other poison apple assets to. They're already out there, court, in the field, doing what they're told. While you're trying to save the world by yourself. Every day you're not here pulling your weight is another day Romantic and Anthem are under more stress, more risk. Anthem isn't even 100% after what happened to her back in Scotland. You remember that little incident, don't you? My voice feels weak in my mouth as I answer back with, "Yes, sir." And then, just to hammer home a point that needed no further hammering, he says, "You're risking your girlfriend's life with all these crusades of yours. Don't forget that." Hanley is referring to Anthem, one of the three poison apple assets. She is Zoya Zakharova, former Russian intelligence, and also formerly someone I was in something of a relationship with. The relationship is strained for a couple of reasons right now, not the least of which is that I shot her. I don't claim to know all the rules of dating, but I'm pretty sure if you shoot someone, then you can't really refer to them as your girlfriend. But Hanley is turning the screws on me because he knows I still care about her. But Zoya is tough, as tough as or tougher than I am, and as tough as or tougher than the women and girls I'm desperately trying to help. She can handle herself in the field. Sorry, Matt. That shit doesn't work on me. I'll be back with you as soon as I can. First, I've got to try to do something. What are you going to do? I'm going to Venice, and there I'll talk to somebody who can actually help me. I hang up the phone, knowing that this will piss Hanley off, but I don't really care. He could have lifted a finger to get me some assets directed to this, and he should have done so. Fuck him. He doesn't know it yet, but he's about to do me a favor, and the thought of how annoyed he'll be when he realizes he did in fact help me out makes me smile. I walk back over to Talissa, who pulls a hot croissant stuffed with ham and cheese out of a bag and hands it to me, along with a cup of coffee.
That didn't look like it went well at all.
Not great, no. But I have someone else I can call. She cocks her head.
Who?
I answer with, if I can't work with the good guys, I'm gonna work for the bad guys. The Romanian woman looks at me like I've lost my mind, so I clarify. Not those bad guys. Some other bad guys. She has no idea what I'm talking about, and that's for the best. I send a few texts before we get back on the highway, and then, a little more than an hour later,
I get the call approving my request for a face-to-face meeting with a man in Venice. Talissa doesn't lift her head out of her computer for the next 3 hours of our drive. Every now and then, she takes a bite out of an apple or sips some bottled water, but she remains completely focused on her work. Finally, as I'm arriving at the northern outskirts of Treviso, a city not 30 minutes from Venice proper, she leans her head back and groans like some sort of a wounded animal. I take it something's wrong. She ignores me while she rubs her eyes, then takes a long swig of water. Finally, she says,
I'm so close, but I can't do anything.
What do you mean?
I've been going back through everything I have on the consortium, all the relationships between all the companies, all the capital equipment I can trace to them, the plane, the yacht, stuff like that. I've traced bank accounts to the Caymans and the Dominican Republic and Crete and Luxembourg. But I'm no closer to finding out who the people are who run this thing.
I was hoping she'd be able to pull a rabbit out of her hat with her research, because I have serious doubts about my plan for tonight. Still, I see that you tried. Sometimes there is no answer.
There is an answer. It's just not available to me. If someone could hack into one of the law firms around the world that set up these offshore accounts, then they could swim upstream into the account information.
You think the name of the director of the consortium would be tied to these accounts? I don't know much about money laundering, but I know they keep an air gap between themselves and the illicit money.
Of course, the accounts won't have the names of the people in charge, but they will have information on where the transfers came from. Investment firms, hedge funds, real estate brokers. That would lead me to the actual men and women who run this whole thing.
Her plan sounds as likely as mine now. Yeah, but you can't hack into the law firms. Can you? She shakes her head.
No, I can't. I mean, there are people out there who can, but they are criminals, and they sure as hell won't work for me.
Do you know who they are?
Some of them. Europol is involved with investigations around the EU where we have identified hackers.
Are they in jail? She shrugs, rubbing her neck.
Some are, most aren't. The wheels of justice move very slowly in Europe. It's not like in America, where they put you in the gas chamber the day after they know you did it.
Her English is amazing, but her knowledge of the nation of my birth is lacking. An idea comes to me slowly, and even as it begins to form, I ask her about it. These people under investigation, do they know you are watching them?
Well, technically, Europol isn't watching them. Their nation's law enforcement entities are. But I do know who some of these people are.
Where is the closest hacker who has the skills to do what you need? She thinks this over carefully. It looks to me like she enjoys the mental exercise of remembering the names and locations. She says,
there are some good ones in Romania.
Do they have protection?
Well, they work with organized crime, but virtually all of the black hat hackers at this level do.
Virtually all? Is there someone who isn't tied to any crime syndicate? Again, she thinks in silence.
Well, for what I need, there is one man who has the skills and is not aligned with any known mafia group.
Where is he?
He's in Amsterdam, which, coincidentally, is only an hour or so from my office and home in The Hague. His name is Martin Meyer. We've been watching him for a while. He used to work in private banking for ING Group, a Dutch multinational, but he was caught embezzling. They fired him but did not prosecute him. They thought they'd lose private clients if they made too much noise about it.
If they didn't prosecute, how do you even know about him?
We only learned of this after he was suspected by Dutch authorities of data theft at ABN AMRO, another large bank in Amsterdam. He was interviewed. He was suspected, but again, he was not prosecuted. There was some question at Europol about whether he was paying off high officials. We never found out. But the investigation into him continues. Interpol is looking into some data thefts in Antigua and Barbuda, and some others in the Caymans. He is highly skilled at picking the cyber locks of banks.
You think he could get into the bank transfer codes you need to identify where the money is coming from?
Talissa nods.
I know he can.
I lift up my phone and change my GPS destination. Here's what I need.
You want to go find him and beat him up until he agrees to do what you need?
No. Finding out who runs the consortium might save Roxana, but it won't save the girls we've been chasing. I have to go to Venice to try to find out where they are being sent. She's confused. So, I say, I need you to go to Amsterdam to convince Martin Meyer to work with us.
But even if I could get him to do the hack, that's totally illegal.
I hate to break it to you, Talissa, but the doing things by the book ship sailed a long time ago. You're pretty much an international criminal already. She says nothing, so I finish my thought. If there is some way to find out that intel, even if it's legal, we probably should be considering it. Slowly, she nods.
But how do I convince him to help us?
Tell him he's under investigation. Tell him you'll tip him off to a raid when it comes if he does what you want him to. Tell him you'll destroy evidence to help his case. Tell him anything to get him on board with us.
But I can't do any of those things.
You don't have to do anything. You just have to say you'll do something to help him.
What? Then we just fuck him over?
Pretty much. Look, think about your sister. Now she looks at me with hard, narrow eyes.
Think about my sister? That's all I am doing. I can't think about anything else at all other than what has happened to her and what will happen to her if I can't get her back. Don't tell me to think about my sister.
I'm sorry. That was a stupid thing to say. I just need you to start breaking some dishes here. I need you to go to Amsterdam and convince Martin Meyer to help us find the money launderers. If I could do it myself, I'd put that guy's nuts in a vise and start flaying him. But I have to stay here.
I am not going to put his nuts in a...
You won't have to. You just need to use what you have to get his compliance, and that is information about the international warrant being prepared against him. I can see she's still pissed at me, but slowly she begins to calm down.
I can do that.
I know you can. We'll go to the airport, and then you're going to Amsterdam. 33. La Primorosa made good speed for Venice, arriving just after 8 a.m. Jacob Verdoorn was all but in command on the vessel now. The captain did little more than drive the boat while the big South African organized the quick and efficient disembarkation of the product. He knew he had to get all the merchandise, along with all the evidence, off, in case the Gray Man had resources to have the yacht boarded. The consortium controlled a portion of local law enforcement here, but it certainly didn't control all law enforcement, so there was a definite threat as long as the yacht was in the area. By noon, Verdoorn had removed his people from this potential compromise, relocating all 23 pieces of merchandise shipped on La Primorosa to a large private residence in Venice proper, on the Rio della Senza, a canal on the northern side of the city. The impromptu safe house building was run by the Mala del Brenta, one of the local mafia groups here in northern Italy, and now all items were sequestered in several rooms on the second and third floors, while armed Italians guarded them. As was always the case on market days, the women and girls were well fed and given plenty of time to bathe. Clothing was brought in by stylists, hair and makeup would begin at 5 p.m., and Dr. Riesling spent the entire day speaking with each one of them privately, checking their mental state for what was to come. Jacob Verdoorn established a secondary security cordon around the building, positioning most of his White Lion men in the streets and along the canals, eyes open for any hint of Cortland gentry. A couple more men had overwatch on the route Cage would take to the safe house, and Verdoorn was in near constant communication with Sean Hall so they could perfectly coordinate the movement of the principal during his short walk. Verdoorn himself planned on taking an overwatch position, both today for Cage's arrival at the safe house and this evening as Cage and his security men went to the market. The South African had a Belgian FN F2000 rifle with a scope and a laser, and he wished for nothing more in this world than to see gentry in his sights today or tonight. He was experienced enough to recognize that there was an extremely low probability of he himself killing the target, but this was his op, these were his men, and they'd received his training, so if any one of his boys took out the American assassin,
he'd consider it his kill.
After dropping Talissa off at the airport, I take the causeway to Venice and park the car at a lot on the western side of the 121 islands that make up the city proper. I climb out, stretching my legs and back. It's just past noon. I have some time before my 2 p.m. appointment, so I use it to do some shopping and to rent a room for the night. I find a little place in Santa Croce on the Rio de Santa Maria Maggiore, and here I take a shower, and then, with scissors and a razor purchased during my stop at a pharmacy, I go to work. I'm wearing a suit I bought off the rack an hour and a half ago, and cherry wingtip shoes purchased just after that. My face is clean-shaven for the first time in months, and my hair is slicked back with product, and although this is hardly my normal look, I've made a career out of blending in with my surroundings, and I am certainly dressed for the part I'm about to play. Then I go back out onto the street to walk to my nearby meeting. Venice is a tourist trap. The narrow streets and passages are packed so tightly with foreign travelers that you shuffle along like cattle. Restaurants all sell the same food, and gift shops all sell the same few dozen items. It's the Disney World of Italy. I've only been here once, doing a job for the Goon Squad a few years back. The agency was tailing a Tunisian lawyer they thought had ties to Al-Qaeda, and my unit of ground branch operators was brought in to roll him up, which we did in an alleyway near his flat on a moonless night. It was a textbook op. We shuffled the guy to a waiting Cessna citation, and then we watched it climb into the Italian sky. Never heard what happened to the lawyer, or even if he was, in fact, tied to AQ, but that was standard operating procedure back then. I was a sled dog on a team. Nobody told me where we were going, and my job was simply to respond to the crack of the whip. Now I have authority over my actions, and I have discretion to move forward or to pull back. But Venice seems so much more ominous today while working on my own than it did back then as part of a cell of American operatives.
34. At 2 p.m., I step up to the nondescript door of an equally nondescript building on the Fondamenta Santa Caterina. There is construction going on around this building and those nearby, and I look over some of the workers and wonder if they are really who they purport to be. I'm guessing not. I'm assuming a lot of them are armed, and I'm pretty sure all of them knew I was coming. I really hate being looked at, but in times like these, it's part of the job. I'm frisked inside the door by a pair of young guys wearing coveralls. I know for certain they are Italian mafia, and they are just wearing the blue-collar work duds as a cover. They take my phone and wallet, but I've left my pistol and the rest of my gear at the rental unit so as not to get anyone excited. A woman descends a wooden staircase and shakes my hand, then escorts me back up. She's all smiles, but I see the armed goon watching me from the mezzanine and feel the presence of one of the guys I met at the front door looming close behind me now as I ascend. Soon I enter the library and find myself face to face with Giancarlo Ricci, the security chief for the Alfonso crime family, one of several mafia concerns here in northern Italy. The Alfonsis aren't as connected and don't have as much reach as some of the Sicilian and Calabrian groups, and they are nowhere near as powerful in Venice as the Mala del Brenta organization, but regionally they are relatively big players. I've spoken with Ricci before, but never in person. I've done work for him, and he's been happy with the service I provided, so as soon as I knew I was heading to Venice without any support from the agency, I decided to reach out to him. Still, I'm going to have to do one hell of a dance to get any assistance from the Alfonsi clan. Just like the CIA, the Italian mob doesn't simply hand out favors for the asking. I'm wearing the suit and I've combed my hair and shaved my face for one reason only. I can't come in here looking like the flailing, scrambling, exhausted, beat-to-shit-lost puppy that I am right now. I need an air of control, a visage of power, and at least a modicum of authority. Ricci would have tossed me out on my ass here if he didn't think I was in a position to do something in exchange for what I'm about to request from him. Giancarlo Ricci stands and shakes my hand, but I can see that his eyes are wary. More than once, he flashes a glance in the direction of the two men standing nearby, and their hands are crossed in front of them, where they can quickly reach inside their jackets to pull a weapon. I wait for Ricci to talk, showing him the respect I imagine he garners from all his subordinates. When he does talk, I'm reminded how good his English is. It's flawless, in fact. He has the look and demeanor of a European who grew up not in his home country, but in a Swiss boarding school, where he was no doubt taught five languages. He doesn't ask me to sit down. Instead, he says, I spoke with the gray man over the phone a few times, as I recall, but I've never met him in person, and I've never seen a photograph. How do I know that you are you? I did a job for you 3 years ago. I can go into detail if that will help. No need. Just tell me what I told you when it was done. You gave me a warning in no uncertain terms. You told me not to double-cross you. You said the Alfonsi family wasn't the largest organization around, but you have a lot of friends, and the right kind of friends to settle scores. Almost correct. My employer, Luigi Alfonsi, he has friends. I myself do not have any. He shrugs. It comes with this life. You certainly understand that, don't you? I don't answer. I am not prepared to agree that his life and my life have any points of connection beyond this meeting. Instead, I say, well, since I didn't double-cross your employer, I hope you will consider me a friend now. With a smile and a dramatic shrug, Ricci says, I must confess, I am confused. They say you are invisible. A pause as he looks me head to toe. But I see you. The man may be a mafia security chief, but he's also hilarious. I reply, when I want to be seen, I can make it happen. When I want to disappear, same thing. Ricci nods again. He appears more relaxed now, and he motions to a chair in front of where he had been sitting when I entered. See? Very good. We both sit while coffee is poured, and I don't hesitate to drink down a hot gulp. Ricci makes no small talk, and I'm glad for this, because I don't have a hell of a lot of time. I say, you want to know why I'm here, right? With another flash to his security men, Ricci says, I don't think you are here to kill me. Most of the people who want me dead insist on trying to do it themselves. They don't hire someone else. I have that effect on people for some reason. He smiled, at ease now, considering the situation. So, yes, I want to know why you are here. I need something from you. The man shrugged. Maybe I need something from you, too. Of course you do. I understand how this works, signore. You help me, and I help you. You will have my services at your disposal as soon as I'm done with the project I'm involved in now. Who are you working with? I sip more coffee, and a man in a fitted blue suit refills my cup. I say, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. People lie to me all the time, so you may be right about that, but tell me anyway. I am not working with anyone. I am on my own. That seems hard to believe. You are one of the highest paid assassins in the world. I didn't come here to lie to you. Ironically, that itself is a lie. I've come here to do just exactly that. The man does not speak for several seconds. Bene, what do you need? A group of trafficked sex slaves is in town. They will be sold at a market tonight, here somewhere in Venice. I'd like to know where this is. Ricci drinks coffee, then raises an inquiring eye to me. You are speaking of the girls from the pipeline? He knows, as I knew he would. Now I can only pray he's not involved with it. If he is, I'm diving out the window in front of me, or else I'll go after the closest armed man and fight to get his weapon out of his hand. But I know both of these options would come with a very low probability of success. Ricci puts his cup down and leans back. The pipeline. Are you wondering if they are us? They are not. The consortium is aligned with Mala de Brenta here. Bad men in that organization. I just nod and say, I'm not a fan of the MDB. He says, they are our competitors. Disrupting their operations, as long as it can't be tied to us, would give us pleasure.
I start to speak again, to tell him I would be happy to fuck with the MDB on my own if he just gives me the intel I require. But before I can tell him this, he says, I'd like to help you, signore. Truly. But there is one problem.
What's that?
The consortium. They serve a purpose. They help my firm with, how do you say it, securing some of our earnings.
Shit. The consortium launders money for Alfonsi. Apparently they are quite good at that part of the equation, too, I remark.
Ricci shrugs. It's a big business.
I am dead certain Ricci's organization makes a lot of money from prostitution. He and his boss are probably just as bad as the men I'm after. But frankly, I've got a pretty full to-do list right now, so I'm not going to worry about that. I spend a lot of time with strange bedfellows when I work in the private sector. It's pretty much my modus operandi. I need to convince him I'm not going to disrupt his organization's money laundering needs. So I say, this has nothing to do with the consortium. This has to do with Mala del Brenta. I figured your boss wouldn't have any problem with my screwing around with them. You and your staff have plausible deniability. I was never here, and I certainly was never working for you. He regards me a long time before asking, why do you want to know where the trade will happen? When I don't answer immediately, he smiles. You want to rescue one of the girls, is that it? That's a good story. Let's go with that. I nod. For her father, an old friend from my days working in Russia. Ricci's eyebrows rise again, and I can't tell if he believes me. Finally, he says, if I give you the location of the sale, what will you do with it? Holding intense eye contact, I reply, my plan is to wait for my girl to be sold, then separated from the others, and then I'm going to get her back from the people who bought her. I'm assuming security will be easier to manage once she's moved. You will act in Venice, or once the girl is taken to her final destination? I will act at first opportunity, no matter where that is. He takes this in for a minute. I know that telling him I would wait till they were out of the area before I start kicking ass would have earned me more favor, but I'm hoping he regards my comment as honesty, and he'll offer up some brownie points to me for not insulting his intelligence.
Giancarlo says, so,
though you may act here in the city, it will only be against the buyer, and only for the purposes of recovering your missing property.
Yeah, he just called the victim's property. I'm in bed with a prick, but I knew that going in. And what choice do I have? He's like Vukovic, and probably like all the others involved in human trafficking. The dehumanization of the women and girls is absolute, a necessity for the twisted minds who scout them, take them, smuggle them, and abuse them. And this motherfucker in the 5,000 euro suit in front of me is no better. But I'm in character here, I say. I'm not trying to make life more difficult here for anyone. I just want the property back. He presses.
You can assure me there will be no disruption of the consortium's work itself here in Venice. You have no plans to target the organization. That is what you are saying.
He wants to help me. That much is evident. Without batting an eyelash, I say, none whatsoever. I just want to bring a nice girl home to her father.
Ricci nods thoughtfully. If I give you information, you must do a job for me.
A difficult job. And this is, of course, why he wants to help me. I ask, where is this job? A pause.
America.
Shit. I don't know the job, the target, the location, or the threat, and I certainly have my doubts about the morality. There's no way in hell I'm killing some dude in the United States for the Italian mob. But I need a break here. I say, the moment I have the girl back to her father, I will go to the States and do whatever you want me to do. This is going well. And just as I think this, I recognize that Ricci is suspicious of how well it is going. Finishing his coffee and putting the cup down, he says,
the story going around about you, as I'm sure you are aware, is that you double-crossed your masters in the CIA.
I reply flatly, they started it. He laughs, surprising me. Maybe so, maybe so. But you know my brotherhood is not like the CIA. I will find you if you double-cross me, as you've told me before. And as I will remind you again, you do not want me as an enemy. You do not want Luigi Alfonsi as an enemy. Is that clear? I have every intention of double-crossing the man across the table, but I also happen to be a pretty good liar. You can count on me, sir. Well then, Ricci sticks out a hand and I shake it. I will give you information. Tell me about the market. It's held by the consortium for their best customers, 6 times a year or so. He nods. And you are correct, it is tonight. It begins at midnight. The location? It's in a building that adjoins the Casino of Venice. It's invitation only, needless to say, and invitations are scarce and well checked. How much security will be there? Ricci shrugs. Mala del Brenta men, 2 dozen or so the last time I heard. The consortium will have their own security. That's a lot of guns, but I imagine that's not all of it. I assume security will be well beefed up after what I did in Bosnia and Croatia and out on the Adriatic Sea. It sounds like a no-go zone for me, and my heart sinks. His next words do nothing to assuage my frustration. It will be incredibly difficult for one man to get inside the event. I can't help you there. I'm desperately thinking about sewers, air ducts, rooftop access, and the like. And I'm thinking about stealing credentials and uniforms from employees of the venue. Hell, I'm even thinking about finding a way to steal or forge an invitation. None of it sounds promising, especially because I know the opposition will be checking all these avenues of approach to make sure some jackass isn't trying to slip into their party tonight. But then Ricci brightens up. There is a bar. It's 2 blocks away. I can get you in there. If I remember correctly, you'll be able to see the building where the market is being held. You will be an employee just for tonight. No one will bother you. Just do a little work, then run off and do what you need to do. You won't be able to get close to the casino, but it's along the route anyone leaving the building will take to get to the main street. This probably looks to Ricci like a completely safe option for me to get some reconnaissance tonight. But I know what he doesn't. The consortium is looking for me, and they'll be ready. Still, I don't see any better opportunity for getting real eyes on and getting pictures of the buyers and sellers. I stand and extend a hand. That sounds perfect, signore. It's not perfect. It's not even close. But it's as good as I'm going to get, and again, I have to look like I know what I'm doing. 35. The pilot of the Dassault Falcon 50 lined its nose up between the runway and identifier lights beaming out of the dusk, checked his adherence to the glide path, and listened while his computer told him he was 1,000 feet above the ground. The pilot worked for Air Branch, the CIA Special Activity Center's air wing, and this meant he was one of the best flyers on Earth. Before qualifying to fly the relatively sleek and advanced Falcon 50, he'd flown fat and slow twin otters off muddy and rocky jungle strips in Central America and Southeast Asia, so big, wide, and flat that runway 04 right, dead ahead and a half mile out, was a piece of cake. In the cabin of the aircraft behind him, the flight attendant strapped herself into the folding bulkhead seat, and then she rubbed her hands and wrists repeatedly. This was only Sharon's 3rd agency flight since she'd been wounded in a tarmac shootout while on board a CIA Gulfstream a couple months earlier. Both her hands still ached where the bullet had smashed into them, but she'd passed her medical requirements a week and a half earlier and had been returned to duty. Facing aft, she was able to gaze upon the 6 men seated in the captain's chairs. They were all in their 30s and 40s. Many wore longer hair and beards. They were quiet and soft-spoken and had been no trouble during the 8.5-hour flight from Reagan National in D.C. Sharon had been doing this long enough to recognize a ground branch unit when she saw one.
These were CIA paramilitary operations officers, among the most highly trained fighters on planet Earth. Individually, they looked normal. They could be oil rig workers or construction workers or any other banal job that required manual labor. But together, to a practiced eye like Sharon's, these were obviously American intelligence commandos. The Dasso touched down moments later at Aeroporto di Treviso, 20 miles northwest of the city of Venice, and then it taxied to a fixed base operator on the southwestern side of the airport. Here the plane parked on the ramp, 100 yards away from the doors to the FBO. The pilot and co-pilot shut it down, while in the back the passengers readied their equipment. The arrival of the CIA flight had been arranged and approved by Italian officials, who were told these men were NATO forces and tied to the nearby U.S. airbase at Aviano. There were no checks of customs or immigration, and this was a black flight allowed by the Italians. Chris Travers stood in the low cabin and turned back to his team. At 35 years old, he was young to be running his own six-man ground branch unit, but he'd proven himself in the U.S. Army as a special forces officer, as a CIA para-unit member, and then, finally, as a second-in-command on a ground branch team. After the death of his team leader and meritorious accolades for Travers's actions during the event where TL died, Travers himself was promoted to team leader. Ground Branch reported to the director of the Special Activities Center, who reported directly to the deputy director for operations, but things on tonight's op were a little bit more streamlined than normal, because command authority of the entire operation was not located in Langley. Tonight, command authority rested with the man sitting in the darkness in the back of the cabin. This figure said nothing while Travers gave final instructions to his crew, even though he himself had once run a team not unlike the one sitting in the cabin with him. Travers said, "Listen up. We have a 16-passenger van waiting to take us into the city. As I told you before, our mission this evening is the location and removal of a CIA asset codenamed Violator. We have a general understanding of where he will be, but no good timeline. So we're heading there now. Will remain clandestine, and will use non-lethal means to obtain his compliance with our commands." One of the older men on the team muttered, "Yeah, right," and others around him chuckled. Everyone on the team had been around the block enough to know the legend of Violator, aka the Gray Man, but only Chris and the man sitting in the back of the aircraft knew the former CIA employee personally. Travers addressed his doubtful subordinate directly. "Yeah, I hear you. We all know Violator is a badass, and if we can't talk him into coming along with us, then this will get ugly. But that's our op, so if you don't like it, you can go fuck yourself." This received a few chuckles as well, including from the man who'd seemed to doubt the wisdom of taking on Violator in the first place. The team leader continued, "We know he's worked with the Luigi Alfonsi family in the past. We're going to set up surveillance around the quarter where the Alfonsis are strongest, and if we get more specific location intel, I'll flex you over to those areas as necessary. This might take some time, so be prepared for a long night." The men hefted packs and filed out of the aircraft in silence. Travers was the last through the hatch, but as he neared the stairs, he turned around and looked at the man in darkness in the back. "Hey, you coming?" Chris Travers saw the silhouette of the man as he reached for his bottle of Corona and took a slow sip. "Nah, you boys run along. I'm gonna hang out here." Travers shrugged. "Long flight not to get off the plane. Figured you'd want a chance at a little action." The man chuckled softly, then said, "I might be seeing more action than you tonight, kid." "Whatever." Travers left the aircraft, then climbed into the van with his men. When he was gone, the man in the back of the cabin called up to the front. "Sharon?" The flight attendant stepped up as the man dialed a number on his phone.
"Sir?"
"I'm going to put you on the phone with someone. He's going to give you some direction for this evening." She cocked her head.
"Yes, sir. Can I ask what this is about?"
"Of course. He's going to tell you that you are to do whatever I tell you to do."
I'm sorry, sir. I don't know who you are, but I am pretty certain I don't work for you.
No, you don't. But you do work for him.
He tapped a button, putting his sat phone on speaker, and then a voice said,
Miss Clark, this is Matthew Hanley, DDO. I need you to listen very carefully.
The flight attendant sat down in a captain's chair with wide eyes.
I'm listening, sir.
I sit in my rented flat on the Ruga Giofa, watching the last of the day's light fade through the dirty windows.
Giancarlo says,
I caught a few hours' sleep and ate in a restaurant down on the first floor of the building, careful to sit far in the back to avoid any detection from the street. But it's 8:45 p.m. I'm back in the room, and it will be full-on dark soon, which means it's almost time for me to leave. Before I set out, I call Talissa, who should be on the ground in Amsterdam, en route to the home of black hat hacker Martin Meyer. She answers on the second ring, which I take as a promising sign.
Hello?
It's Harry. You made it there?
I'm outside his house. I don't think he's home.
That's okay. You knew you might have to wait.
I don't know if I can do this.
You can, and you can call me if you need help. Remember, you have your Europol credentials and a lot of information about his crimes and the investigation underway. Come at him hard, threatening even, but then show him a way through the door. You have to make him want to work with you so he doesn't end up in prison.
But what if he says no? What if your plan doesn't work?
This isn't going to work, I tell myself. Then I tell Talissa, it's going to work, trust me. After a moment, she replies softly and with no obvious confidence.
All right. I will call you when I have him.
Then she says,
while I'm doing this, what will you be doing?
I'll be doing what I do best.
Which is?
What do you think?
Talissa heaves a long sigh.
You are going to try to catch someone and beat information out of them.
You know me too well.
I am worried about her, just like I was back in Dubrovnik when she had been rolled up by the Albanians. But now I can't do anything to help her. She's on her own.
Listen, I say, if it's not working out, if you feel like you might be in any danger, then you need to just pull out of there. I can try later.
Later, all the girls will be gone.
I know. I just don't want you getting hurt.
She sniffs into the phone.
Thank you, Harry. You be careful, too.
30 minutes later, I am out on the street, walking east through the artificial lights towards the Casino of Venice. I begin focusing my attention on my mission this evening. I need to be gray to blend in with my surroundings, more so with each step as I near my target location. Talissa can pull this off, I tell myself. I can pull this off too. It's an affirmation born not out of real conviction, but rather out of desperation. We have to pull this off.
Ken Cage stepped out of the bathroom off the foyer of the Mala del Brenta safe house with a long, labored sniff. Then he rubbed his eyes and nose. He grabbed his black suit coat off a leather wingback chair, slipped it on, looked to his bodyguard, and gave him an energetic nod. Cage knew Sean Hall would understand that this meant he was ready to leave for the auction. Hall immediately slipped on his own jacket, then radioed his team through his cuff mic. Within moments, the six men appeared in the foyer and formed around their boss and their principal. Hall gave the men last-minute instructions, then radioed Jaco Verdoorn. He had no idea where the South African and his men were stationed outside, but he knew they would be trying to spot Gentry, if he was even in the area at all. Verdoorn acknowledged Hall's message that the movement was beginning, but he gave the American lead protection agent no more information about his and his team's disbursement around the route to the auction. With a head bob by Hall in the direction of the exit, the point man on the cage detail opened the door and the entourage began filing out. It was 11:45 p.m., nearly 9 hours after they'd arrived at the safe house. Cage walked along through the surprisingly cool July night, wiping sweat from his forehead with a handkerchief as he did so. He wasn't feeling great right now. He'd done enough Viagra, cocaine, and ecstasy this afternoon and evening to flare up his angina to the point where it felt like a steam hammer was pounding around inside his chest. For Ken Cage, a full day of sex required no small amount of external assistance, and the side effects of all the stimulants were as wearing on him as the physical activity itself. He'd slept for a few hours after his exertions. The girls had been moved to the market in the early evening, so there was nothing else for him to do, but it was an uncomfortable sleep with the drugs pumping through him. He put away the handkerchief and, from the same pocket, pulled out a few Valium he'd staged there to calm his heart, swallowing them dry. Still, despite his chest pain, he'd felt he'd had a pretty good day. He'd had sex with three of the girls, all of whom would be sold off in the next few hours to Saudi sheiks or Asian billionaires or diamond-level prostitution agencies in Belgium or Holland. He'd been rough with the merchandise, even rougher than usual, in no small part because he was frustrated by the events of the past few days. In all his working life, this was the first time that some entity seemed to have a personal stake in upsetting one of the most lucrative veins of his wealth. He dealt with rival operations, mobsters in competition with mobsters who worked for him, but that was just business. But this Uber killer chewing his way along the pipeline, this was something else. And Cage was angry at his employees like he'd never been in the past. At Hall for showing fear and doubt when up against one lone man, and at Verdun for being unable, despite all the resources Cage had afforded him, to find and end this persistent threat. As the entourage turned down a narrow side street, he looked up to the roofs and immediately saw a man looking down on them. He didn't say anything to Hall, because he knew this would be one of Yako's guys, and Hall would only freak out until this was confirmed. He walked on, thinking about the girls who would be sold off tonight. He'd looked over each and every one. He'd also paid a short visit to the cream of the crop here. The two girls he'd ordered sent to Rancho Esmeralda, and been waiting to get his hands on, both occupied their own quarters on the third floor, and Cage had gone to visit them both. He found Sophia to be compliant, but Dr. Claudia Riesling had told him she'd administered a large amount of Xanax to the 18-year-old Hungarian shortly after her arrival because she hadn't had time enough with the girl to bring her into line. Maya, on the other hand, had not been drugged. Cage found her inquisitive, obstinate, the same free spirit he'd encountered in Bucharest months earlier. She had nothing but questions about where she'd go and who she would be around, and Cage thought, a few minutes into their conversation, that the doctor should have plied her with pills as well, before he came. But Maya had not been any real trouble, per se. Claudia had told Cage upon his arrival that she'd worked especially hard with the young Romanian, and she felt that her psychological reprogramming had been successful. Cage had not laid a finger on either of the Rancho Esmeralda-bound women. There would be time enough for that when they got to Southern California in a couple of days. Now it was approaching midnight, and the entourage walked through the Calle Larga Vendramin after being dropped off by a pair of 8-meter-long speedboats a couple blocks from the casino. The boats had rumbled away, and everything was perfectly silent around Cage, apart from the men's footsteps in the narrow alleyway. The coke was wearing off. He told himself he'd need one more line when he got to the market. His phone chirped in his pocket, and he answered it loudly and abruptly, showing that perhaps his coke had not, in fact, worn off to the extent he'd first thought.
Yeah, who is it?
Daddy,
a young female voice said.
It's Juliet.
Cade shook his head to clear his mind. He'd been thinking of sex and drugs and hitmen and bodyguards, but quickly he had to morph himself back into the family man role he played.
Hey, honey, how are you?
Mom won't let me go over to Madeline's tonight. It's summer. I'm bored here. Can I tell her you said it's okay?
Cage sighed and continued walking while talking to his 12-year-old daughter, his voice echoing off the stone buildings all around him. Chris Travers took the call on his sat phone at midnight, just as he found a position at the Rialto Bridge that gave him incredible sight lines along the Grand Canal. The phone was Bluetoothed to his earpiece, so he flipped off the interteam radio and took the call, stepping away from the group of tourists he'd blended with to avoid detection by gentry.
Zulu Actual.
IDEN 664, November Alpha, India.
He recognized the voice of Suzanne Brewer, an operations officer who worked directly for Deputy Director Hanley. He recognized her identity code as well.
IDEN confirmed, Travers said. My IDEN is 46 Bravo Sierra 9 Kilo.
Roger, Zulu. Be advised, I have new targeting information for you.
Target can be located in or around the Casino of Venice in Cannaregio, 2040. Be advised that while we believe he is working alone, the area will likely be populated with third-party hostiles, forces from the Mala del Brenta crime organization.
Travers scribbled this all down on a small pad.
Got it. Interrogative. Where did we get this information?
That's a need to know only, Zulu. Just treat the intel as credible.
Need to know, Travers thought. Why wouldn't the guys on the ground need to know where the hell the CIA was getting intricate location and disposition of forces intel?
He didn't argue, but he did ask another question.
Do we know the time when the target should arrive at this pos?
Time now, Zulu. Get there ASAP.
Roger that. We're en route.
Suzanne Brewer then said, As per the DDO, the subject is to be taken alive. Is that clear?
Travers sighed in disbelief now. Court Gentry was his friend, more or less. At the very least, they had fought and bled alongside each other. Travers had been given the rules of engagement already, so he knew Gentry wasn't hostile. Gentry was just being Gentry, doing his own thing, and the DDO wanted his ass dragged back to the East Coast so he could be put back in service. Yeah, he might not want to go, and he would try to escape and evade. Gentry might even throw a fist or try out some of his whiz-bang judo shit. But neither side was going to pull guns on each other. Court was a good man in the Ground Branch team leader's book, despite what the agency brassholes said about him from time to time. There was no way Travers or his team was going to kill him, and Brewer's stressing of the rules of engagement just made him dislike the already dislikable woman even more. But Travers was a good soldier. He kept his voice much more dispassionate than he felt as he replied, Alive, understood in Wilco. He then transmitted on his inter-team radio,
Listen up, Zulu. New target coordinates. One click my paws on foot to the east. Everybody flex over there and double time it.
36. Here I am, in yet another dark room, in yet another congested European city, looking out yet another dirty window in search of yet another group of assholes. At times like these, I can't help but wonder if I should have gone to college. I've been working at the packed restaurant and nightclub downstairs for the past 2 hours, carting ice to the bartenders, changing out kegs of beer, and schlepping cases of wine and liquor down 2 flights of stairs, then schlepping the empty bottles out to a loading dock in the back. But at 12:45, I slipped away from my assigned duties, picked an office door lock on the 2nd floor, and found an overwatch position above the alleyway that looked directly out towards my objective. I'm sitting in the dark, staring down at my target location, waiting for something to happen. The Casino of Venice is an ornate palace with a simple facade, tucked away in a tiny square surrounded by taller structures. Next door to it is a square building with a pair of large red wooden doors on the other side of a stone forecourt with an impressive iron gate. I see several people milling about inside the gate, all male, all dressed in fine suits. These don't look like security, and they don't look like Italian mafia to me. So I'm guessing these shitheads are the buyers. I'm assuming there are more inside, and I'm also assuming the women from Mostar have already been brought in, either via the passageways in front of me and off to my left, or else through some sort of back entrance. The building does back up onto a small canal, so I know I may miss some of the comings and goings, but I also know beggars can't be choosers, and this spot gives me a good chance of getting a look at some of the players. I pull out my camera and begin taking pictures of the men I see, all the while scanning the buildings, windows, and alcoves within sight. I take it to be a 100% chance that the consortium will be on the lookout for me, and they'd be idiots not to put surveillance at the front entrance to tonight's market.
but despite my searching, I don't see any threats except a couple of goons standing at the casino door. Still, I know they are out here somewhere, close to me, hunting me. I keep shooting images, but soon I hear a voice in the alleyway off to my left. I don't move closer to the window to improve my angle so that I can get a visual on the noise, but instead I patiently wait for whoever is talking to come into view. Finally, a group of 7 or 8 men, all in business suits, walk together in a tight profile, casting one long shadow as they pass in front of a street lamp. One of their number is talking loudly, in an animated fashion, as if he is on the phone. I can't make out the words, but I can hear that he's speaking English. I focus on the middle of the cluster of men as they turn and begin down the alleyway towards the casino entrance. I see the top of a bald head, barely visible among the much taller men around. I see a phone to his ear and realize he's the one speaking. Who the hell is this guy? I don't know why I'm asking myself that, because I know. He's American, short, bald, and obviously important. This is exactly how Roxana Vaduva described the director of the consortium. Holy shit, I say to myself. If Roxana was aware that the man she knew as Tom was going to be in Venice tonight, she sure didn't tell me. I saw no signs of her trying to deceive me back on La Primarosa, so I'm guessing she had no idea he'd be making an appearance. This makes me wonder if she was correct about her going to the USA after the sale. And it also makes me worry, because if the director is here, it may mean he's already raped her. I close my eyes and fight to push the thought out as a wave of guilt washes over me. I tell myself I could have found a way to get her off that boat, even if she didn't want to go. I know I could have, but if I'm being honest with myself, I know exactly why I didn't do it. Roxana was absolutely right. She was Talissa's best chance for finding out who was running the consortium. I left her there, on the yacht and in mortal danger because she was our agent in place, and, despite the risks to her, we needed her in play. I'd never tell her sister this in a million years, but it's the truth. Roxana's life was worth risking for me to complete my mission. And knowing all this does nothing to mitigate the guilt I'm feeling. I open my eyes, refocus on my objective, and start taking pictures like a madman. Soon, the men enter the tiny square, then step through the iron gate in front of the house next to the casino. They walk through the small forecourt and enter through the red doors. I don't get a single usable shot of the man in the middle of the security detail. Son of a bitch. All I can do now is sit here till they leave and shoot images of anyone else who comes and goes. There are over 20 women who will be lost in the wind forever. Unless I can ID the shitheads who are taking them. I settle into place, ready to wait this out. Willem Clerk stood inside a well-lit gelato shop on the Rio Terra San Leonardo, biting into a pistachio cone and gazing only intermittently out onto the touristy street, still relatively crowded at 12:30. He was the only White Lion operative in a 3-block radius, and as he listened in to the others reporting from their positions, all closer to the market, he put his own chances for sighting the gray man as low. He ate more of his gelato as his eyes focused on a pair of men walking a meter apart through the crowd. He'd noticed they were moving a little faster than others around them, and this pace set them apart at first. But that was not all that Clerk found remarkable in the pair. He watched them as they passed, then scanned behind them for signs of others who might be with them. He did see one man who interested him but quickly discounted him when he stopped walking and picked up a menu from a rack in front of a restaurant. Then he brought his hand to his mouth and spoke softly into his cuff mic.
Lion Actual, Lion 8. I've got a pair of suspicious characters on the main street up here. Describe them. Subject 1 is white, 30s, gray jeans and brown shirt. Subject 2 is white, 40s, off-white shirt and black pants. They have small rucks with them. They are moving with intent in your direction.
Verdurin replied, We're looking for one man, not two.
Either of them look like the target. Negative? Neither of these blokes is gentry, but they are somebody. Maybe they're confederates.
Verdorn paused as he thought, then said,
Or maybe they're hunting him, same as us. CIA has been after him for years. These two definitely could be from American intelligence. If they are, they might be watching you now.
Negative.
Saw one potential follower, a military-aged male with a pack, but he didn't look American. These other boys are Yanks for sure, Verdorn said.
Copy.
Clerk then asked, What do you want me to do?
Verdorn paused a moment, then replied,
Tell him. The rest of you stay on mission. Gentry is the primary target. These new fucks are just a curiosity.
Clerk brought his cuff mic down, stepped out onto the street, and continued eating his gelato as he slipped in behind the pair. 75 feet behind the South African, a third-generation Mexican-American CIA ground branch officer named Teddy Gonzalez put the laminated menu he'd been holding back in the rack at the outdoor cafe. Then he brought his own hand to his mouth.
Zulu 4 to Zulu Actual.
A second later, he heard Travers's voice through his earpiece.
Go for Zulu. Be advised. I've got a subject on your 6. Looks like he's made you. Can't see him clearly, but don't think it's our target. He look like he's carrying? Can confirm he's armed with an ice cream cone. Anything else on him is concealed at my distance. Roger that. We'll do an SDR to confirm. I'll tail and report.
Gonzalez caught a glimpse of his team leader and Zulu 5 as they turned left down Calle Rabia, a narrow passageway that led to the north, away from the casino area. Their surveillance detection run would lead the potential follower away from the rest of the ground branch team, and it would lead them away from their target. He then began following the unknown subject half the distance away and saw him bring his hand to his mouth. He couldn't tell if the man was transmitting through his cuff mic or just taking a bite from his cone. A few seconds later, the lone man turned north on Calle Rabia.
He's still on you, Zulu. Roger that. If you're sure, we'll drop the SDR and lose him. Head back to the target location. All Zulu elements run SDRs to see if there are others out there.
Gonzalez rogered up, then said,
I can get ahead of you. Check my own 6. And then find a route for you guys to slip your tail.
Do it, Travers said.
Teddy Gonzalez walked past Calle Rabia, then picked up his pace. He made his own left at Calle Messina, walked through the darkened alley, then stepped into an open rear doorway into the kitchen of a restaurant. Slipping past the cooks hard at work, he made his way to the dining room undetected, then exited the front. Once he saw he could make his way back down to the main street from here, he transmitted to Travers with the location, confident they could lose their one-man tail easily. A few minutes later, Willem Klerk's frustrated voice came through Jaco Verdorn's earpiece.
Lion Actual, this is 8. I've lost the scent.
Did they shake you, or did you just fuck it up?
Don't know. They didn't see me, dead certain of that. But I can't say there wasn't someone back behind me I didn't recognize who alerted them.
All right, Verdorn replied.
Bring the ring in tighter. If Gentry is here at all, he'll come to the bloody market. I want all lions within 100 meters. If CIA is here, we'll be ready for them too.
Kenneth Cage stood in the lobby just off the sales floor of the palace, where the market was being held. Behind him, in the darkened great hall, 4 of the women had already been paraded across a small riser, surrounded by buyers, then sold off, each going for over 1 million euros. A 15-year-old Ukrainian, a 22-year-old Bulgarian, a 19-year-old Macedonian, and a 16-year-old Romanian were already the property of 4 different criminal organizations, and would soon be shipped off to Dubai, Frankfurt, Bangkok, and Stockholm, where they'd be condemned to a life of servitude. There was a break in the action now while the next 4 were paraded to go on the block, so Cage and some of the buyers from a group of Gulf states stood in the lobby chatting and drinking whiskey. Hall stood close by his charge, but his attention was partially focused on listening in to Verdurn's men on his earpiece as they discussed a potential new threat. During a pause in the conversation in the lobby, he leaned into Cage's ear. "Sir, Yako's team has identified a pair of unknown men in the area. We need to..."
"Is one of them that gentry prick?"
"No, sir, but they think..." With a dismissive wave, he said,
"Yako will handle it. Don't bother me while I'm working again,"
and returned to his conversation. Hall knew Cage was coked up again,